One study compared Alzheimer's rates to dietary variables across 11 different countries and found that populations with a high fat intake and low cereal and grain intake had higher rates of the disease. We seem to be on to something. Clearly, diet has an important voice in determining how well we think in our later years. But what exactly is good for us? With regard to the more mild cognitive impairment condition, recent research has shown that high vitamin E levels in the blood are related to less memory loss. Less memory loss also is associated with higher levels of vitamin C and selenium, both of which reduce free radical activity. Vitamins E and C are antioxidants found almost exclusively in plant foods, while selenium is found in both animal and plant-based foods. In a study of 260 elderly people aged 65 to 90 years, it was reported that a diet with less fat, saturated fat and cholesterol, and more carbohydrate, fiber, vitamins, especially folate, vitamin C and E, and beta-carotenes, and minerals, iron and zinc, may be advisable not only to improve the general health of the elderly, but also to improve cognitive function. This conclusion advocates plant-based foods and condemns animal-based foods for optimal brain function. Yet another study on several hundred older people found that scores on mental tests were higher among those people who consumed the most vitamin C and beta-carotene. Other studies have also found that a low level of vitamin C in the blood is linked to poorer cognitive performance in old age, and some have found that B vitamins, including beta-carotene, are linked to better cognitive function. The seven studies mentioned all show that one or more nutrients found almost exclusively in plants are associated with a lower risk of cognitive decline in old age. Experimental animal studies have not only confirmed that plant foods are good for the brain, but they also show the mechanisms by which these foods work. Although there are important variations in some of these study findings, for example, one study only finds an association for vitamin C, and another only finds an association for beta-carotene and not vitamin C, we shouldn't miss the forest by focusing on one or two trees. No study has ever found that consuming more dietary antioxidants increases memory loss. When associations are observed, it is always the other way around. Furthermore, the association appears to be significant, although more substantial research must be done before we can know exactly how much cognitive impairment is due to diet. What about the more serious dementia caused by strokes, vascular dementia, and Alzheimer's? How does diet affect these diseases? The dementia that is caused by the same vascular problems that lead to stroke is clearly affected by diet. In a publication from the famous Framingham study, researchers conclude that for every 3 additional servings of fruits and vegetables a day, the risk of stroke will be reduced by 22%. 3 servings of fruits and vegetables is less than you might think. The following examples count as one serving in this study: 1/2 cup peaches, 1/4 cup tomato sauce, 1/2 cup broccoli, or 1 potato. 1/2 cup is not much food. In fact, the men in this study who consumed the most fruits and vegetables consumed as many as 19 servings a day. If every 3 servings lower the risk by 22%, the benefits can add up fast. Risk reduction approaches but cannot exceed 100%. This study provides evidence that the health of the arteries and vessels that transport blood to and from your brain is dependent on how well you eat. By extension, it is logical to assume that eating fruits and vegetables will protect against dementia caused by poor vascular health. Research again seems to prove the point. Scientists conducted mental health exams and assessed food intake for over 5,000 older people and monitored their health for over 2 years. They found that the people who consumed the most total fat and saturated fat had the highest risk of dementia due to vascular problems. Alzheimer's disease is also related to diet and is often found in conjunction with heart disease, which suggests that they share the same causes. We know what causes heart disease, and we know what offers the best hope of reversing heart disease: diet. Experimental animal studies have convincingly shown that a high cholesterol diet will promote the production of the beta amyloid common to Alzheimer's. In confirming these experimental animal results, a study of more than 5,000 people found that greater dietary fat and cholesterol intake tended to increase the risk of Alzheimer's disease specifically, and all dementia in general. In another study on Alzheimer's, the risk of getting the disease was 3.3 times greater among people whose blood folic acid levels were in the lowest one-third range, and 4.5 times greater when blood homocysteine levels were in the highest one-third. What are folic acid and homocysteine? Folic acid is a compound derived exclusively from plant-based foods such as green and leafy vegetables. Homocysteine is an amino acid that is derived primarily from animal protein. This study found that it was desirable to maintain low blood homocysteine and high blood folic acid. In other words, the combination of a diet high in animal-based foods and low in plant-based foods raises the risk of Alzheimer's. When the first edition of this book was published, the then existing evidence on the causes of Alzheimer's was only suggestive, though it did indicate a causal pathway, and thus solution, similar to that of other Western diseases. Due to the recent surge in interest in Alzheimer's, about 90% of the available research on Alzheimer's disease has been conducted in the past 15 years. Much of that has been geared toward better understanding of some basic cellular mechanisms that lead to an entanglement of twisted nerve fibers, mostly affecting the memory center of the brain. I must confess that I am not that impressed. This devastating disease is upon us, and few, if any, research leads are suggesting how people can avoid it. The only dietary recommendation being advanced is to adhere to a heart-healthy diet, based on the hypothesis that the Western diet causes a buildup of the beta-amyloid protein plaque in the brain, the same way cholesterol builds up and causes plaque in our arteries. More specifically, the Alzheimer's Association recommends the Mediterranean and DASH, Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension, diets, the latter of which, in particular, is only a very modest improvement compared to the standard American diet. The WFPB diet is much more effective in reversing heart disease than the Mediterranean and DASH diets. The same could be true for Alzheimer's as well. Mild cognitive impairment, the stuff jokes are made of, still permits the afflicted person to maintain an independent, functional life. But dementia and Alzheimer's are tragic, imposing almost impossibly heavy burdens on victims and their loved ones. Across this spectrum, from minor difficulties in keeping your thoughts in order to serious degeneration, the foods you eat can drastically affect the likelihood of mental decline. The diseases I've covered in this chapter take a heavy toll on most of us in our later years, even though they may not be fatal. Because they are not usually fatal, many people afflicted with these illnesses still live a long life. Their quality of life, however, deteriorates steadily, until the illness renders them largely dependent on others and unable to function in most capacities. I've talked to so many people who say, "I may not live as long as you health nuts, but I sure am going to enjoy the time I have by eating steaks whenever I want, smoking if I so choose, and doing anything else I want." I grew up with these people. Not long ago, one of my best friends suffered a difficult surgery for cancer and spent his last years paralyzed in a nursing home. During the many visits I made to the nursing home, I never failed to come away with a deep appreciation for the health I still possess in my old age. It was not uncommon for me to go to the nursing home to visit my friend and hear that one of the new patients in the home was someone whom my friend and I knew from our earlier days. Too often, they had Alzheimer's and were housed in a special section of the facility. The enjoyment of life, especially the second half of life, is greatly compromised if we can't see, if we can't think, if our kidneys don't work, or if our bones are broken or fragile. I, for one, hope that I am able to fully enjoy not only the time in the present, but also the time in the future, with good health and independence. Part 3. The Good Nutrition Guide. I was in a restaurant, looking at the menu, when I noticed a very peculiar low-carb meal option. A massive plate of pasta topped with vegetables, otherwise known as pasta primavera. The vast majority of calories in the meal clearly came from carbohydrates. How could it be low carb? Was it a misprint? I didn't think so. At various other times, I've noticed salads, breads, and even cinnamon buns labeled low carb, even though their ingredients list demonstrate that, in fact, the bulk of calories are provided by carbohydrates. What's going on? This carb mania is largely the result of the late Dr. Atkins and his dietary message. Later, Dr. Atkins's new diet revolution was toppled and replaced by the South Beach diet as the king of the diet books. The South Beach diet is pitched as being more moderate, easier to follow, and safer than Atkins. But from what Tom and I can tell, the weight loss wolf has just put on a different set of sheep's clothing. Both diets are divided into three stages. Both severely limit carbohydrate intake during the first phase, and both are heavily based on meat, dairy, and eggs. The South Beach diet, for example, prohibits bread, rice, potatoes, pasta, baked goods, sugar, and even fruit during the first 2 weeks. After that, you can be weaned back onto carbohydrates until you are eating what looks like a fairly typical American diet. Perhaps this is why the South Beach diet has been such a hot seller. Before the first edition of the China Study was published, Newsweek wrote of South Beach, "The real value of the book is its sound nutritional advice. It retains the best part of the Atkins regime, meat, while losing the tenet that all carbs should be avoided." Who at Newsweek reviewed the literature to know whether this is sound nutritional advice or not? And if you have the Atkins diet plus some carbs, how different is this diet from the standard American diet, the toxic diet that has been shown to make us fat, give us heart disease, destroy our kidneys, make us blind, and lead us to Alzheimer's, cancer, and a host of other medical problems? These are merely examples of the current state of nutrition awareness in the United States. Every day, we are reminded that Americans are drowning in a flood of horrible nutrition information. Remember the adage from several decades ago? Americans love hogwash. Another one. Americans love to hear good things about their bad habits. It would appear from a quick glance that these two sayings are true. Or are they? We have more faith in the average American than that. It's not true that Americans love hogwash. It's that hogwash inundates Americans, whether they want it or not. Some Americans want the truth. They just haven't been able to find it because it is drowned out by hogwash. Very little of the nutrition information that makes it to the public consciousness is soundly based in science, and we pay a grave price. One day, olive oil is terrible. The next, it is heart healthy. One day, eggs will clog your arteries. The next, they are a good source of protein. One day, potatoes and rice are great. The next, they are the gravest threats to your weight you will ever face. At the beginning of the book, we said our goal was to redefine how we think about nutrition information, to eliminate confusion, make health simple, and base our claims on the evidence generated by peer-reviewed nutrition research published in peer-reviewed professional publications. So far, you have seen a broad sample, and it's only a sample, of that evidence. You have seen that there is overwhelming scientific support for one simple optimal diet, a whole foods, plant-based diet, WFPB. We want to condense the nutritional lessons learned from this broad range of evidence and from my 40-plus years of experiences into a simple guide to good nutrition. We have whittled this knowledge down to several core principles, ones that will illuminate how nutrition and health truly operate. Furthermore, we have translated the science into dietary recommendations that you can begin to incorporate into your own life. Not only will you gain a new understanding of nutrition and health, but you will also see exactly which foods you should eat and which foods you should avoid. What you decide to do with this information is up to you, but you can at least know that you, as a reader and a person, have finally been told something other than hogwash. Chapter 11. Eating Right, 8 Principles of Food and Health. The benefits of a healthy lifestyle are enormous. We want you to know that, based on the information presented in this book, you can increase the odds that you will live longer, look and feel younger, have more energy, lose weight, lower your blood cholesterol, prevent and even reverse heart disease, lower your risk of prostate, breast, and other cancers, preserve your eyesight in your later years, prevent and treat diabetes, avoid surgery in many instances, vastly decrease the need for pharmaceutical drugs, keep your bones strong, avoid impotence, avoid stroke, prevent kidney stones, keep your baby from getting type 1 diabetes, alleviate constipation, lower your blood pressure, avoid Alzheimer's, beat arthritis. These are only some of the benefits, and all of them can be yours. The price? Simply changing your diet. It has never been so easy or so relatively effortless to achieve such profound benefits. We have given you a sampling of the evidence and told you the journey that we have taken to come to our conclusions. Now we want to summarize the lessons about food, health, and disease that we have learned along the way in the following 8 principles. These principles should inform the way we do science, the way we treat the sick, the way we feed ourselves, the way we think about health, and the way we perceive the world. Principle number 1. Nutrition represents the combined activities of countless food substances. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. To illustrate this principle, we need only take you through the biochemical perspective of a meal. Let's say you prepare sautéed spinach with ginger and whole grain ravioli, stuffed with butternut squash and spices, topped with a walnut tomato sauce. The spinach alone is a cornucopia of various chemical components. Chart 11.1 is only a partial list of what you might find in your mouth after a bite of spinach. As you can see, you've just introduced a bundle of nutrients into your body. In addition to this extremely complex mix, when you take a bite of that ravioli with its tomato sauce and squash filling, you get thousands and thousands of additional chemicals, all connected in different ways in each different food. Truly, a biochemical bonanza. As soon as this food hits your saliva, your body begins working its magic, and the process of digestion starts. Each of these food chemicals interacts with the other food chemicals and your body's chemicals in very specific ways. It is an infinitely complex process, and it is literally impossible to understand precisely how each chemical interacts with every other chemical. We will never discover exactly how it all fits together. The main message we're trying to get across is this. The chemicals we get from the foods we eat are engaged in a series of reactions that work in concert to produce good health. These chemicals are carefully orchestrated by intricate controls within our cells and all through our bodies. And these controls decide what nutrient goes where, how much of each nutrient is needed, and when each reaction takes place. This is nature at work. Our bodies have evolved with this infinitely complex network of reactions in order to derive maximal benefit from whole foods as they appear in nature. The misguided may trumpet the virtues of one specific nutrient or chemical, but this thinking is too simplistic our bodies have learned how to benefit from the chemicals in food as they are packaged together, discarding some and using others as they see fit. We cannot stress this enough, as it is the foundation of understanding what good nutrition means. Principle number 2. Dietary supplements are not a panacea for good health. First, let us define what we mean by a dietary supplement. The FDA states that a dietary supplement taken orally may be a tablet, capsule, soft gel, gel cap, liquid, or powders. It may include vitamins, minerals, herbs or other botanicals, amino acids and/or concentrates, metabolites, constituents, or extracts. This definition is very broad. When we use dietary supplement here, we mean products composed of nutrients, vitamins, minerals, amino acids, and not necessarily herbal and other similar products, which may consist of complex concentrates of whole foods. For example, in China, watermelon is an herb. Because nutrition operates as an infinitely complex biochemical system involving thousands of chemicals and thousands of effects on your health, it makes little or no sense that isolated nutrients, taken as supplements, can substitute for whole foods. Supplements will not lead to long-lasting health and may cause unforeseen side effects. Furthermore, for those relying on supplements, beneficial and sustained diet change is postponed. The dangers of a Western diet cannot be overcome by consuming nutrient pills. I have followed the development of the nutrient supplements business from its modern beginning during the mid-1980s, since which time it has become a $32 billion a year industry. Two pieces of congressional legislation set the table for this explosion. The first was the 1976 Proxmire Amendment to the government's official food and drug regulations that allowed the industry to sell nutrient supplements without a doctor's prescription. The second was the 1994 Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, DSHEA, which established standards for these products, thus adding some marketplace credibility. In the interim, the industry also got a huge scientific boost from the highly publicized 1982 National Academy of Sciences report on diet, nutrition, and cancer that I co-authored, although that boost was unintended. We recommended increased consumption of fruits, vegetables, and whole grains because they contained certain beneficial nutrients, but we also explicitly said that this was not to be interpreted as a recommendation to use isolated nutrients in dietary supplements. The industry aggressively argued otherwise and pushed on in spite of a decision by the U.S. Federal Trade Commission that their health claims were deemed inappropriate. This aggressive behavior eventually paid off in what must be one of the biggest health hoaxes of all time, the nutrient supplement industry. It's abundantly clear to us why this massive industry has emerged. Huge profits are an excellent incentive. Furthermore, consumers want to continue eating their customary foods, and popping a few supplements makes people feel better about the potentially adverse health effects their diet causes. Embracing supplements means the media can tell people what they want to hear, and doctors have something to offer their patients. As a result, a multi-billion dollar supplement industry is now part of our nutritional landscape, and the majority of consumers have been duped into believing that they are buying health. This was the late Dr. Atkins's formula. He advocated a high-protein, high-fat diet, sacrificing long-term health for short-term gain, his followers, but especially his own, and then advocated taking his supplements to address what he called, in his own words, the common dieter's problems, including constipation, sugar cravings, hunger, fluid retention, fatigue, nervousness, and insomnia. This strategy of gaining and maintaining health with nutrient supplements, however, started to unravel in 1994 to 1996 with the large-scale investigation of the effects of supplemental beta-carotene, a precursor to vitamin A, on lung cancer, and other diseases. After 4 to 8 years of supplement use, patients' lung cancer had not decreased as expected. It had increased. No benefit was found from vitamins A and E for the prevention of heart disease either. Since then, numerous additional trials costing hundreds of millions of dollars have been conducted to determine if vitamins A, C, and E prevent heart disease and cancer. 2 major reviews of these trials were published shortly before the first edition of the China study. The researchers, in their words, could not determine the balance of benefits and harms of routine use of supplements of vitamins A, C, or E, multivitamins with folic acid, or antioxidant combinations for the prevention of cancer or cardiovascular disease. Indeed, they even recommended against the use of beta-carotene supplements. In the decades since this book was first published, the main science-based findings have agreed. Supplements are overrated, with little or no redeeming value. It is not that all these nutrients aren't important. They are, but only when consumed as food, not as supplements. Isolating nutrients and trying to get benefits equal to those of whole foods reveals an ignorance of how nutrition operates in the body. A 2003 special article in the New York Times documents this failure of nutrient supplements to provide any proven health benefit. We are confident that as time passes, we will continue to discover that relying on the use of isolated nutrient supplements to maintain health while consuming the usual Western diet is not only a waste of money, but is also potentially dangerous. There are, however, 2 possible exceptions to this. The first is vitamin B12. Many clinicians have been advocating regular vitamin B12 for individuals consuming the WFPB diet, which does not contain this vitamin. A variety of hematologic and neurologic symptoms attributed to B12 deficiency have been noted, and they are readily treated by supplementation. It is difficult to make firm quantitative recommendations on B12 needs, given the current state of research. However, there is no evidence that B12 supplementation causes adverse health effects, and clinicians have found that B12 administration resolves apparent B12 deficiency symptoms. Thus, it makes common sense that regular B12 supplementation should be encouraged. See more on B12 in the next section. The second possible exception is vitamin D, though a similar incomplete story exists here. Vitamin D is not a vitamin. It is not a nutrient that we need to consume. Instead, it is a hormone. Our bodies can make it when we get enough sunlight exposure. The amount of sunlight generally considered necessary is only 15 to 30 minutes per day, though admittedly this can be problematic in the northern climates, where there is much less daylight during the winter months, especially for children who fail to go outdoors. The original research on vitamin D showed that a deficiency was associated with rickets in children, although since then it has been shown to be critically involved in several other aspects of health. In spite of the media attention that vitamin D has received in recent years, the scientific literature supporting supplementation is not as impressive as one might think. A highly reputable research task force recently concluded, based on a survey of the research literature, that little or no benefit for bone fracture risk was obtained when marginally D-deficient people were treated with vitamin D, although they urged that more research was needed. Another task force report on vitamin D questioned its benefits, reporting that there is, at the moment, no firm evidence that vitamin D supplementation increases or decreases cancer risk. Whether someone has enough vitamin D is assessed by measuring the 25-hydroxyvitamin D metabolite, calcidiol, stored in the liver. This is not the most active metabolite involved in vitamin D function. That would be the metabolite 1,25-dehydroxyvitamin D, calcitriol, derived from the metabolism of calcidiol. Calcitriol is, according to some estimates, about three orders of magnitude, 1,000 times more potent than calcidiol. And the body decides how much of this powerful hormone to produce as needed on a microsecond-by-microsecond basis. Furthermore, it is questionable to assume that the amount of vitamin D you have in reserve relates to functionality. When your natural gas tank is only 20% full, does this slow down the flame at the stovetop? The flame can be equally robust until the amount in the tank is virtually gone. Even when stored D, calcidiol, is relatively low, the body should still be able to produce the amount of calcitriol it needs for healthy function. There are still cases of rickets and osteomalacia, softening of the bones, in which vitamin D deficiency is so great that bone growth and maintenance becomes dysfunctional in North America. This illustrates that, for at least a small number of people, the consequences of vitamin D deficiency are very real. Risk is determined by several factors, including location, lifestyle, skin color, and clothing choices. For those at risk, small daily doses of vitamin D can prevent frank deficiency. Too much vitamin D, however, can be toxic, so please consult your doctor before beginning supplementation on your own. Principle number 3. There are virtually no nutrients in animal-based foods that are not better provided by plants. Overall, it is fair to say that any plant-based food has many more similarities in terms of nutrient composition to other plant-based foods than it does to animal-based foods. The same is true the other way around. All animal-based foods are more like other animal-based foods than they are to plant-based foods. For example, even though fish is significantly different from beef, fish has many more similarities to beef than it has to rice. Even the foods that are exceptions to these rules, such as nuts, seeds, and processed low-fat animal products, remain in distinct plant and animal nutrient groups. Eating animals is a markedly different nutritional experience from eating plants. The amounts and kinds of nutrients in these two types of foods, shown in Chart 11.2, illustrate these striking nutritional differences. As you can see, plant foods have dramatically more antioxidants, fiber, vitamins, and minerals than animal foods. In fact, animal foods are almost completely devoid of several of these nutrients, but they have much more cholesterol and fat. They also have slightly more protein than plant foods, along with more B12 and vitamin D, although the vitamin D is largely added to milk. Of course, there are some exceptions. Some nuts and seeds are high in fat and protein, for example, peanuts, sesame seeds, while some animal-based foods are low in fat, usually because it is stripped by artificial processing, for example, skim milk. But if one looks a little more closely, the fat and the protein of nuts and seeds are different. They are more healthful than the fat and protein of animal foods. They also are accompanied by some interesting antioxidant substances. On the other hand, processed, low-fat, animal-based foods still have some cholesterol, lots of protein, and very little or no antioxidants and dietary fiber, just like other animal-based foods. Because nutrients are primarily responsible for the healthful effects of foods, and because of these major differences in nutrient composition between animal and plant-based foods, isn't it therefore reasonable to assume that we should expect to see distinctly different effects on our bodies depending on which variety of foods we consume? By definition, for a food chemical to be an essential nutrient, it must meet two requirements. The chemical is necessary for healthy human functioning. The chemical must be something our bodies cannot make on their own, and therefore must be obtained from an outside source. One example of a chemical that is not essential is cholesterol. A component of animal-based food that is non-existent in plant-based food. While cholesterol is essential for health, our bodies can make all that we require. We do not need to consume any in food. Therefore, it is not an essential nutrient. There are four nutrients that animal-based foods have that plant-based foods, for the most part, do not: cholesterol and vitamins A, D, and B12. Three of these are non-essential nutrients. Cholesterol our bodies make naturally. Vitamin A our bodies can readily make from beta-carotene, and vitamin D we produce simply by exposing our skin to about 15 minutes of sunshine every couple of days. Both of these vitamins are toxic if they are consumed in high amounts. This is one more indication that it is better to rely on the vitamin precursors, beta-carotene and sunshine, so that our bodies can readily control the timing and quantities of vitamins A and D that are needed. As discussed in principle number 2, vitamin B12 is more problematic. Vitamin B12 is made by microorganisms found in soil and the intestines of animals, including our own. The amount made in our intestines is not adequately absorbed, so it is recommended that we consume B12 in food. Research has shown that plants grown in healthy soil that has a good concentration of vitamin B12 will absorb this nutrient. However, in the United States, plants are not a reliable source of B12. We live in such a sanitized world that we rarely come into direct contact with the soil-borne microorganisms that produce B12. At one point in our history, we may have gotten some B12, from vegetables that hadn't been scoured of all soil, in addition to any animal food we consumed. Therefore, it is a good assumption that modern Americans who eat highly cleansed plant products and no animal products will not get enough vitamin B12. Though our society's obsession with nutrient supplements seriously detracts from other far more important nutrition information, this is not to say that supplements should always be avoided. It is estimated that we hold a 3-year store of vitamin B12 in our bodies. If you do not eat any animal products, particularly if you are pregnant or breastfeeding, you should take a small B12 supplement regularly and consider getting tested for B12 levels. If they are on the low side, consider getting confirmatory tests for methylmalonic acid and homocysteine, which are considered to be better indicators of vitamin adequacy as well. Likewise, if you never get sun exposure, especially during the winter months, you might wish to take a vitamin D supplement and make more of an effort to get outside. Principle number 4. Genes do not determine disease on their own. Genes function only by being activated or expressed, and nutrition plays a critical role in determining which genes, good and bad, are expressed. We can safely say that the origin of every single disease is genetic. Our genes are the code for everything in our bodies, good and bad. Without genes, there would be no cancer. Without genes, there would be no obesity, diabetes, or heart disease. And without genes, there would be no life. This might explain why we are spending hundreds of millions of dollars trying to figure out which gene causes which disease and how we can silence the dangerous genes. This also explains why some perfectly healthy young women have had their breasts removed simply because they were found to carry genes that are linked to breast cancer. This further explains why the bulk of resources in science and health in the past decade has shifted to genetic research. At Cornell University alone, $500 million is being raised to create a life sciences initiative. This initiative promises to forever change the way life science research is conducted and taught at the university. What is one of the main thrusts of the program? Integrating each scientific discipline into the all-encompassing umbrella of genetic research. It is the largest scientific effort in Cornell's history. Much of this focus on genes, however, misses a simple but crucial point. Not all genes are fully expressed all the time. If they aren't expressed, they remain biochemically dormant. Dormant genes do not have any effect on our health. This idea is obvious to most scientists and many lay people, but its significance is seldom understood. What causes some genes to remain dormant and others to express themselves? The answer? Environment, especially diet. To reuse a previous analogy, it is useful to think of genes as seeds. As any good gardener knows, seeds will not grow into plants unless they have nutrient-rich soil, water, and sunshine. Neither will genes be expressed unless they have the proper environment. In our body, nutrition is the environmental factor that determines the activity of genes. As we saw in Chapter 3, the genes that cause cancer were profoundly affected by the consumption of protein. In Collins' research group, they learned that they could turn the bad genes on and off simply by adjusting animal protein intake. Furthermore, the China research findings showed that people of roughly the same ethnic background have hugely varying disease rates. Described by some observers as having similar genes, still they get different diseases depending on their environment. Dozens of studies have documented that as people migrate, they assume the disease risk of the country to which they move. They do not change their genes, and yet they fall prey to diseases and illnesses at rates that are rare in their homeland population. We refer to what others say about the Chinese having similar genes in deference to these others. We do not agree with this assessment. We believe that gene variance among the Chinese is as great as among any other ethnic group, although we are not aware whether this has been scientifically demonstrated. The main point, however, is still the same. Migrants incur diseases of the country to which they move, without changing their genes, however much those genes may vary within the migratory population itself. Furthermore, we have seen disease rates change over time so drastically that it is biologically impossible to put the blame on genes. In 25 years, the percentage of our population that is overweight or obese has doubled, from 15% to 30%. In addition, diabetes, heart disease, and many other diseases of affluence were rare until the most recent century, and our genetic code simply could not have changed significantly in the past 25, 100, or even 500 years. So while we can say that genes are crucial to every biological process, we have some very convincing evidence that gene expression is far more important, and gene expression is controlled by environment, especially nutrition. A further folly of this genetic research is assuming that understanding our genes is simple. It is not. Researchers reported in 2003 their studies of genetic regulation of weight in a tiny worm species. The scientists went through 16,757 genes, turning each one off, and observed the effect on weight. They discovered 417 genes that affect weight. How these hundreds of genes interact over the long term with one another and their ever-changing environment to alter weight gain or loss is an incredibly complex mystery. Goethe once said, "We know accurately only when we know little. With knowledge, doubt increases." Expression of our genetic code represents a universe of biochemical interactions of almost infinite complexity. This biochemical universe interacts with many different systems, including nutrition, which itself represents whole systems of complex biochemistry. With genetic research, we suspect we are embarking on a massive quest to shortcut nature, only to end up worse off than when we started. Does all this mean we think that genes don't matter? Of course not. If you take two Americans living in the same environment and feed them exactly the same meaty food every day for their entire lives, it would not be surprising if one died of a heart attack at age 54 and the other died of cancer at the age of 80. What explains the difference? Genes. Genes give us our predispositions. We all have different disease risks due to our different genes. But while we will never know every risk to which we are predisposed, we do know how to control those risks. Regardless of our genes, we can all optimize our chances of expressing the right genes by providing our bodies with the best possible environment, that is, the best possible nutrition. Even though the two Americans in our example succumbed to different diseases at different ages, it is entirely possible that both could have lived many more years with a higher quality of life if they had practiced optimal nutrition. Principle number 5. Nutrition can substantially control the adverse effects of noxious chemicals. Stories of cancer-causing chemicals regularly appear in the press. Acrylamide, artificial sweeteners, nitrosamines, nitrites, ALAR, heterocyclic amines, and aflatoxin have all been linked to cancer in experimental studies. There is a widely held perception that cancer is caused by toxic chemicals that make their way into our bodies in a sinister way. For example, people often cite health concerns to justify their opposition to pumping antibiotics and hormones into farm animals. The assumption is that the meat would be safe to eat if it didn't have those unnatural chemicals in it. The real danger of the meat, however, is the nutrient imbalances, regardless of the presence or absence of those nasty chemicals. Long before modern chemicals were introduced into our food, people still began to experience more cancer and more heart disease when they started to eat more animal-based foods. A great example of a misunderstood public health concern regarding chemicals is the lengthy $30 million investigation of minimally higher rates of breast cancer in Long Island, New York, referred to in Chapter 8. Here, it seemed that chemical contaminants from certain industrial sites were causing breast cancer in women living nearby. But this ill-conceived story has proven to have no merit. Another chemical carcinogen concern surrounds acrylamide, which is primarily found in processed or fried foods like potato chips. The implication is that if we could effectively remove this chemical from potato chips, they would be safe to eat. Even though they continue to be highly unhealthy, processed slices of potatoes drenched with fat and salt. So many of us seem to want a scapegoat. We do not want to hear that our favorite foods are a problem simply because of their nutritional content. In Chapter 3, we saw that the potential effects of aflatoxin, a chemical touted as being highly carcinogenic, could be entirely controlled by nutrition. Even with large doses of aflatoxin, rats could be healthy, active, and cancer-free if they were fed low-protein diets. We also saw how small findings can make big news every time cancer is mentioned. For example, if experimental animals have an increased incidence of cancer after gargantuan exposures, the chemical agent is trumpeted as a cause of cancer, as was the case for NSAR, see Chapter 3, and nitrites. However, like genes, the activities of these chemical carcinogens are primarily controlled by the nutrients that we eat. So what do these examples tell us? In practical terms, you aren't doing yourself much good by eating organic beef instead of conventional beef that's been pumped full of chemicals. The organic beef might be marginally healthier, but we would never say that it was a safe choice. Both types of beef have a similar nutrient profile. It is useful to think of this principle in another way. A chronic disease like cancer takes years to develop. Those chemicals that initiate cancer are often the ones that make headlines. What does not make headlines, however, is the fact that the disease process continues long after initiation and can be accelerated or repressed during its promotion stage by nutrition. In other words, nutrition primarily determines whether the disease will ever do its damage. Principle number 6. The same nutrition that prevents disease in its early stages, before diagnosis, can also halt or reverse disease in its later stages, after diagnosis. It is worth repeating that chronic diseases take several years to develop. For example, it is generally thought that breast cancer can be initiated in adolescence and not become detectable until after menopause. So we very well may have lots of middle-aged women walking around with breast cancer initiated during their teens that will not be detectable until after menopause. For many people, this translates into the fatalistic notion that little can be done later in life. Does this mean that these women should start smoking and eating more chicken fried steak because they're doomed anyway? What do we do, given that many of us may already have an initiated chronic disease lurking in our bodies, waiting to explode decades from now? As we saw in Chapter 3, cancer that is already initiated and growing in experimental animals can be slowed, halted, or even reversed by good nutrition. Luckily for us, the same good nutrition maximizes health at every stage of a disease. In humans, we have seen research findings showing that a WFPB diet reverses advanced heart disease, helps obese people lose weight, and helps diabetics get off their medication and return to a more normal pre-diabetes life. Research has also shown that early-stage prostate cancer may be attenuated or reversed by lifestyle changes. Some diseases, of course, appear to be irreversible. The autoimmune diseases are perhaps most frightening because once the body turns against itself, they may become unstoppable. And yet, amazingly, even some of these diseases may be slowed or attenuated by diet. Recall the research showing that even type 1 diabetics can lower their medication requirements by eating the right food. Evidence also shows that rheumatoid arthritis can be slowed by diet, as can multiple sclerosis. We believe that an ounce of prevention does equal a pound of cure. And the earlier in life good foods are eaten, the better one's health will be. But for those who already face the burden of disease, we must not forget that nutrition still can play a vital role. Principle number 7. Nutrition that is truly beneficial for one chronic disease will support health across the board. When I was trying to get the first edition of this book published, I had a meeting with an editor at a major publishing house and described to her my intent to create disease-specific chapters that related diet to particular ailments or groups of ailments. The editor asked, in effect, "Can you make specific diet plans for each disease so that every chapter doesn't have the same recommendations?" In other words, could I tell people to eat a specific way for heart disease and a different way for diabetes? The implication, of course, was that the same eating plan for multiple diseases simply wasn't catchy enough, wasn't sufficiently marketable. Although this might be good marketing, it is not good science. As I have come to understand more about the biochemical processes of various diseases, I have also come to see how these diseases have much in common. Because of these impressive commonalities, it only makes sense that the same good nutrition will generate health and prevent diseases across the board. Even if a WFPB diet is more effective at treating heart disease than brain cancer, you can be sure that this diet will not promote one disease while it stops another. It will never be bad for you. This one good diet can only help across the board. So I'm afraid Tom and I don't have a different, catchy formula for each disease, just a single dietary prescription. But rather than be forlorn about its effect on book sales, we'd prefer to remain excited about telling you how simple food and health really is. It is a chance to clear away much of the incredible public confusion. Quite simply, you can maximize health for diseases across the board with one simple diet. Principle number 8. Good nutrition creates health in all areas of our existence. All parts are interconnected. Much has been made of holistic health in recent times. This concept can mean a variety of things to different people. Many people lump all of the alternative medicines and activities into this concept. So, holistic health comes to mean acupressure, acupuncture, herbal medicines, meditation, vitamin supplements, chiropractic care, yoga, aromatherapy, feng shui, massage, and even sound therapy. Conceptually, Tom and I believe in holistic health, but not as a catchphrase for every unconventional and oftentimes unproven medicine around. Food and nutrition, for example, are of primary importance to our health. The process of eating is perhaps the most intimate encounter we have with our world. What we eat becomes part of our body. But other experiences also are important, such as physical activity, emotional and mental health, and the well-being of our environment. Incorporating these various spheres into our concept of health is important because they are all interconnected. Indeed, this is a holistic concept. These expanding interconnections become apparent to me through animal experimentation. Rats fed low-protein diets were not only spared liver cancer, but also had lower blood cholesterol and noticeably more energy, and voluntarily exercised twice as much as the high-protein rats. The evidence regarding increased energy levels has been supported by an enormous amount of anecdotal evidence I have encountered over the years. People have more energy when they eat well. This synergy between nutrition and physical activity is extremely important, and is evidence that these two parts of life are not isolated from each other. Good nutrition and regular exercise combine to offer more health per person than the sum of each part alone. We also know that physical activity has an effect on emotional and mental well-being. Much has been said about the effect physical activity has on various chemicals in our bodies, which in turn affects our moods and our concentration. And experiencing the rewards of feeling better emotionally and being more mentally alert provides the confidence and motivation to treat ourselves to optimal nutrition, which reinforces the entire cycle. Those who feel good about themselves are more likely to respect their health by practicing good nutrition. Sometimes people try to play these different parts of their lives against each other. People wonder if they can erase bad eating habits by being a runner. The answer to this is no. The benefits and risks of diet are crucially important and more sizable than the benefits and risks of other activities. Besides, why would anyone want to try and balance benefits and risks when they can have all the benefits working together? People also wonder whether a perceived health benefit is because of the exercise or because of a good diet. In the end, that's simply an academic question. The fact is that these two spheres of our lives are intimately interconnected, and what's important is that it all works together to promote or derail health. Furthermore, it turns out that if we eat the way that promotes the best health for ourselves, we promote the best health for the planet. By eating a WFPB diet, we use less water, less land, and fewer resources, produce less pollution, and inflict less suffering on our farm animals. John Robbins has done more than any other person to bring this issue to the front of American consciousness, and we strongly recommend reading his 2010 book, The Food Revolution. Our food choices have an incredible impact not only on our metabolism, but also on the initiation, promotion, and even reversal of disease, on our energy, on our physical activity, on our emotional and mental well-being, and on our world environment. All of these seemingly separate spheres are intimately interconnected. We have mentioned the wisdom of nature at various points in this book, and we have come to see the power of the natural world's workings. It is a wondrous web of health, from molecules to people to other animals, to forests, to oceans, to the air we breathe. This is nature at work, from the microscopic to the macroscopic. Whole and holism. Principle number 8 is central to the main theme of my 2013 book, Whole: Rethinking the Science of Nutrition, written with Howard Jacobson. I found I was not satisfied with writing just these few words in the first edition of this book as to why and how metabolic events work together, the way they obviously do, and wanted to delve further into this question, as well as the related question of why people haven't heard this information.